Hello, and welcome back to the Irish Mythology Podcast, where today we reach the end of our saga, the Second Battle of Moytura. I'm Marcus O'Hishkin.
The two a day have won the battle, and all that's left is to see how justice is served on the traitor Brez, how the gods will liberate the stolen cattle of Ireland and restore the natural cycle of the year. I'm Stephanie Hearney.
But before we get to that, there's something we really need to mention. I think it's important for a podcast that spends a lot of time thinking about Irishness and Irish identity, especially from the perspective of our Indigenous mythologies, to comment on some recent events in Ireland. Some absolute grifters, styling themselves as Irish patriots, have been drumming up anti-refugee sentiment. Though support for their ideas is in the minority, the fear-mongering that these tiny far-right organisations have drummed up has led to some protests where people have besieged refugee accommodation and left people who have fled danger at home feeling unsafe here where they have come to seek refuge.
At the moment, there's also a cost of living crisis in the country. Consumer prices in Ireland are the highest in Europe. We have the highest housing costs when for years, multi-billion euro companies have bought large stocks of housing to rent, pushing up the cost of buying or renting a home. Energy prices have skyrocketed while the energy companies report massive profits, and news reports of people in their 90s struggling to heat their homes are now the norm. People working full time on what would previously have been considered reasonable salaries are now unable to make ends meet and going without food so that they can feed their children. And that is the literal reality of it. When people go looking for someone to blame, and there are groups pointing the finger at people who look different or speak different languages, it's very convenient to go along. But ultimately, it just lets the people who make decisions about how we live our lives, their ideas, and the entire political and economic system off the hook. During the Great Hunger, also known as the famine, millions of Irish fled starvation here and found new homes in the US, Canada, the UK, Australia, and other places. Some of you listening today are descended from those very refugees.
And look, the Great Hunger was completely avoidable. I'm sure that if you have ancestors who left Ireland during that time, they wouldn't have left their homes if they had a choice. They had lives here. But having had that choice removed from them by people in power and the socio-economic order of the day, their only hope was to find new homes elsewhere. So we want to state categorically, refugees welcome, and we have absolutely no time for far-right clowns using aspects of Irish mythology or the symbolism associated with it. You'll often hear far-right groups calling themselves traditionalists, but they are absolutely not. There's nothing traditional about racism. Race is a relatively modern concept, and racism is a modernist ideology that has its roots in colonialism, scientifically debunked interpretations of Darwinism, and the bizarre notion that white Europeans are somehow superior or the biblically chosen people of God.
Most of Ireland's minuscule far-right lean towards Christian fundamentalism, but there is a tiny minority that would like to appropriate the gods of our ancestors. Similarly to the way this happens to a far greater extent with Norse mythology in other countries, they have no right, and to be honest, they usually don't have the slightest bit of understanding of the myths and ancient religions of the peoples of Northern Europe anyway.
Frauds. Yeah, the lot of them.
Cead Fine Gael. They're also frauds because while often masking their racism with fake concern for Irish homeless people, it's almost none of them that have been involved in any actual campaigns about homelessness or the cost of living crisis. Really, we are sounding a note of caution when it comes to these types of anti-immigrant charlatans, frankly. Anyway, with that all said, we'll return to the matter at hand. The very last episode in our retelling of the saga, the Second Battle of Moytura.
In our last episode, the Tuatha defeated the Fomorians on the battlefield, but there are a few loose ends to tie up. Brez, the former king of the Tuatha, who was in league with the enemy, has to stand trial, and we'll find out if he has anything to offer the gods in return for his life. After that, the Dagda, Ogma, and Lu join forces to liberate the cattle the Fomorians have stolen and to retrieve the Dagda's harp, whose music keeps the seasons in order. After the story, we'll talk about how this epilogue might point to the meaning of the saga as a whole. The story today is adapted from sections 149 to 165 of the Harleian manuscript text of the Second Battle of Moytura. So without further ado, here's Steffi with Moytura, the final chapter, Wheel of the Seasons.
The war is over. Loch Halfgreen, former poet by appointment to the late Indec Mac de Downan, fallen king of the defeated Formorians, bows before Lu, who sits at the centre of a crescent formation, the War Council of the Tuatha'i. The talks have concluded, terms have been agreed. Loch turns to walk out of the great tent and only gives a sideward glance as the disgraced and bound former king of the Tuatha'i, Brez, traitor to his people and ally of the Fomor, is dragged in by the Dagda and Ogma. Luck's heels are barely visible at the exit as Brez is thrown to the ground before the council. There is what seems to Brez to be a lengthy silence. "May I ask," Brez asks, "who is to speak first? I would have expected it to be you, Lu, but this silence..." "Cunus," Lu demands. "You see," Brez continues, "I feel there's too much of that. That's what I was..." "Brez Makalaha, you have been brought here to face justice," Lu continues. "Due to your crime of treason against your own people, your murderous campaign of raiding and pillaging this land, your part in orchestrating the Battle of Moytura, the council feels that death is the appropriate penalty." Brez pauses for a moment before replying. "Look, I thought you might say that, but if I may offer an argument to the contrary, I feel it would be better to spare me than to kill me." Barely subdued laughter ripples through the tent. "I thought you might say that," Lu responds. "But what do we have to gain from letting you live?" "If you spare me, the cows of Ireland shall always give milk," Brez replies. Lu turns to his advisor, Mailtna Mór Breathach, and the two quietly confer. Finally, Lu gives his answer. "We will not spare you. Sure, even if you can control their milk, you could not control their life expectancy or when they calf." "That's hardly nothing," Brez grumbles. "Meltna's objections are..." "Is there anything else that would be worth sparing you for?" Lu interrupts. "Yes," Brez quickly responds. "I have learned many secrets. Agricultural magic, dark science secrets only known to the Formorian druids. I can give the people of Ireland a harvest of grain every quarter." Once again, Lu turns to his advisor. "Well, Meltna," Lu whispers, "shall we spare him?" "The natural order of things has suited us thus far," Meltna replies. "Spring for ploughing and sowing, and the beginning of summer for maturing the strength of the grain, and the beginning of autumn for the full ripeness of the grain and for reaping it, winter for consuming it." Lu turns back to Brez. "We decline your offer." "Gods, your advisor there is a hard man to please," bemoans Brez. "But hear this," he continues. "Under what moon, on what day will they sow? Under what moon and on what day will they reap? Times for ploughing, reaping, sowing for the best results. These are secrets that are known to me." Once again, Lu confers with Meltna. Without much delay, he returns his attention to Brez and gives his verdict. "Very well, Brez Makalaha. You shall be spared in return for the knowledge you possess. But hear this. You will relinquish all claims to the throne and you will desist from fomenting rebellion." Brez sighs in relief. "There will be no fomenting and I relinquish all of my claims. Now, may I take my leave? I wish to secure the release of my mother from my father's she." "You may," Lu answers.
the council is dissolved. In the dawn's early light, Lou steps out of his tent. He sees the sun rise over the land and breathes deeply in relief that the war is won. The appearance of the Dagda and Akma from their respective tents reminds him that there is one more mission to undertake. The Dagda is followed to his chariot by a single black heifer, which he carefully lifts and places on the vehicle. Lou notices an ornate sword hilt protruding from a sheath on Akma's belt. "New sword?" he inquires. "I found it on the battlefield," Akma replies. "It's quite unusual. When it's out of its sheath, it recounts the tales of its deeds." "Could you give us a demonstration?" the Dagda asks. "To be honest," Akma answers, "the novelty has worn off. I'm starting to find it irritating. No doubt you'll get to hear it on this trip anyway." When each of the three has loaded their chariots, they set out towards the northeast where a ship awaits. Great dark clouds gather over Alaha's island stronghold. The streets of the port town are deserted save for the rivers of rainwater that rush through the streets. The market by the port is abandoned. Animal skin canopies that once covered stalls hang from loose beams and rods that sway back and forth in the wind. Forks of lightning strike the ground as a lone figure arrives at the port and dismounts his horse. Brez looks up at the cloud that is the source of the lightning. "That's no cloud," he mutters. As the cloud begins to descend, Brez sighs. "They didn't waste any time." The cloud begins to take a more tangible form. It takes the shape of a ship and gently lands on the sea by a mooring. Brez does his best to feign a smile as he waves at Lou, Akma and the Dagda as they prepare to disembark. "Glad tidings, fellow gods," he calls out as the three leaders of the Two-A-Day step off the gangway. "Brez, I didn't expect to see you here," the Dagda replies. "Lou gave his blessing. I'm here to bring my mother home," Brez responds hastily. The Dagda looks around at Lou.
"He speaks the truth," Lou confirms.
"You might actually be useful here," Akma muses. "Go ahead to your father's fortress. If he asks about the strange weather, tell him it's just a storm." Brez nods. "And Brez," the Dagda adds, "we'll know if you've warned him." "Don't worry," Brez wearily replies. "I am only here for my mother. When you attack, I'll sneak her away." Brez mounts his horse and rides off inland towards the mountains. When their chariots are loaded with the weapons and provisions they need, and the Dagda's heifer, the three gods set out in the same direction as Brez. The road is steep, and the paving is showing signs of wear and tear. The only sign of life is the squinting of windows as they pass through villages whose buildings have seen better days. The higher they climb on the mountain road, the scarcer settlements become. Soon they notice that there are no more bushes, trees or shrubs, no green at all, and the dreary grey rock that they have just become accustomed to is gradually replaced by black marble. The road narrows until they can no longer ride three abreast. The gradient of their path decreases, and it eventually weaves through a dark mountain pass with towering walls. It comes to a point where the tops of the walls are so high above them they are out of sight, and the road begins to descend. After hours of travel, they see an end to the pass, but it appears to be a dead end. As the three gods get closer to the foreboding rock face, they realize that it is a door. It has no handles or any means of alerting those inside to their presence, but its outline is unmistakable. Then, two figures who look like they are carved out of the rock walls of the pass step out and block their route. "Halt," says one of the beings as he changes shape, becoming less like a black marble statue and more like a man, but with the head of a goat with grey and black speckled fur. "This area is off limits," says the other, who now resembles a goat standing on its hind legs with the same grey and black speckled fur, but with the head of a man. The three chariots are brought to a sudden halt. Akma unsheathes the sword from his belt and throws it in an arc. It slices the heads of the two guards clean off and their bodies turn to rubble and fall in the ground. As the sword completes its arc and returns to Akma's hand, it tells the tale of its most recent deed. "Behold the grave of the rock giants that Akma slew by the blade of Tehra's sword. Now all shall know Akma, mighty with weapons, mightier with words, reduced the giants to rubble at the pass." Akma silences the sword by placing it back in its sheath. "You were right," Lou grumbles. "It is irritating. How are we going to get in there now?" "Leave it to me," the Dagda replies, already picking up his staff from the floor of the chariot. He steps off his vehicle and marches up to the rock face. With both hands, he lifts his staff above his head before bringing it down with force upon the rocky ground. The earth begins to rumble. Stones and small rocks tumble from the cliff face above. The ground cracks and the fissure in the door widens until it is large enough for the three gods to pass through on their chariots. Elaha carefully cuts a slice of roasted venison and places it on his plate. "I have a counter proposal," he says. Era sits silently at the far end of the great black marble table, and Brez sits to the side, halfway between them. "You're in no position to negotiate, father," Brez responds with a sigh. "No, hear me out," Elaha replies. "You stay here with me and your mother and we can live as a family. We can rebuild the kingdom together and there's plenty of land to the east we can conquer." "No more conquest," Brez replies curtly. "Tell him, Era," Elaha demands. Era pushes food around her plate as she meekly complies. "We'll live as a family." "See," Elaha interjects, pointing at Era. "Your mother is happy here." "Well, she doesn't look happy," Brez responds. The conversation is interrupted by the sound of commotion outside the door of the banqueting hall. Elaha stands alert as the doors burst open and the Dagda, Lu, and Akma enter the hall. "Guards!" Elaha calls out. 9 heavily armed warriors pour in from the side door. The Dagda sees his harp hanging on the wall at the back of the room. He reaches out and chants, "Come Dar Dablau, come Kar Kar Kar, come summer, come winter, mouths of harps and bags and pipes." The instrument flies towards him, decapitating the 9 guards on the way to his outstretched hand. Brez runs to his mother and takes her by the hand. "Come on, let's go." The two run to the door, leaving Elaha behind them. As more Fomorian warriors come from the sides, the Dagda begins to play his harp. First, he plays a sorrowful tune, so Alaha and the warriors fall to their knees in tears. Then he plays a joyful tune, so Alaha and the warriors laugh uncontrollably. Finally, he plays sleep music, so that Alaha and the warriors drift off into a deep slumber, and the Dagda, Akma, and Lu leave without a scratch. When the three gods arrive back at the port, they are met by the lowing of cattle. The Dagda's heifer has gathered the stolen herd, and Era and Brez are loading them onto the boat. As the ship ascends, the Dagda begins playing his harp. The clouds clear from the sky, and they set sail for Ireland, bringing the stolen cattle and the natural order of the seasons with them.
I feel like those two events at the end of the saga are there to drum home to people what the story as a whole is really about, and that's the natural balance of the seasons.
Yeah, throughout our retelling of the saga over the last couple of years, we've been asking what it all means. But I think this epilogue gives the game away, and I just want to remind listeners that you can access additional content from us at patreon.com/Irish Mythology Podcast. Throughout the Second Battle of Moytura, the Fomorians are portrayed as disruptors of the natural order. They steal cattle and ruin crops. They disrupt the natural growing cycles that the people of the time rely upon, and they really do represent disorder in the natural world.
We know that the cycle of the year was very important to our ancestors, not just because of stories like these, but also because the festivals they celebrated marked important turning points on the Wheel of the Seasons. In the story of the wooing of Ymir in the Ulster Cycle, the titular Ymir tells Cuchulainn, and I'm quoting from Thomas Kinsella's translation of An Táim Bo Cúinne here, that no man will travel this country, she said, who hasn't gone sleepless from Samhain when the summer goes to its rest, until Imbolc, when the ewes are milked at spring's beginning, from Imbolc to Beltane at the summer's beginning, and from Beltane to Brón Tróin, earth's sorrowing autumn.
The earliest surviving copy of Tocmark Ymir, or The Wooing of Ymir, Osperla, dates from the 15th century, but the text, which consists of only partially modernised Old Irish, suggests a possible date of the 8th century for the first written version. This early written version is almost certainly an adaptation of a story, possibly in poetic form, from the earlier oral tradition. This speaks to its antiquity and to the importance of these seasonal festivals for our pre-Christian ancestors.
It's also interesting that the festival marking the beginning of autumn is named here as Brón Tróin, and not Lunasa as we know it today, which also suggests it's a very old story and backs up our theory outlined way back in episode 18, I think, that Lu was a late addition to the pantheon of Irish gods, possibly in the late 1st century or early 2nd century CE.
The fact that Brón Tróin is translated by Kinsella as Earth's Sorrowing and by Cúnamhar in 1888 as, quote, when the earth is afflicted, also might imply that this part of the story comes from a time when pastoral livestock farming was more important than crop cultivation, which would date it in or before the 2nd century CE. And even though Lu does appear in An Táim Bo Cúinne, he could have been added in later, but we'll talk about that when we tell that story. The point, though, is that this is an ancient story that illustrates the importance of the cycle of the seasons in pre-Christian times.
In the Second Battle of Moytura and its associated tales in Irish myth and folklore, the Fomorians have upset the cycle and the natural balance of nature. They steal cattle, they ruin crops. Alternatively, they might accelerate the growth of crops, ripening them too early so that they spoil before winter. And basically what Brez offers Lou at the beginning of the story is to share knowledge of this science and allow the two a day to make crops grow and ripen at any time of the year and make animals give milk all year round.
Brez is the reason we can buy blackberries in January. This might have been an attractive prospect to people who relied on crop cultivation and livestock farming for their livelihoods. It would mean that there was always an abundance of everything. But Lou's advisor, Melton Na Mórbhreathach, which I think translates from Old Irish as something like balding making big judgments, or a balding high court, a balding high judge.
Apologies to any balding high court judges out there.
God. in his wisdom, he understands that throwing nature out of balance, even with good intentions, has a hidden cost, which will leave the two a day and the people of Ireland in a worse position than where they were following the natural cycle of the year. It would make you think of how things are now, with fruits and vegetables on supermarket shelves all year round, out of season, and with climate change, we are clearly paying the price for manipulating nature, disrupting the natural order of things.
Yeah, and if you're interested in learning more about modern ecological perspectives on animist calendar customs, I would highly recommend the YouTube channel Nordic Animism. It comes from the perspective of the Scandinavian traditions, but you can apply the general gist of the ideas there to an Irish context. And actually, recently enough, there was a video where he has an interview with Mancon Magan on Irish land connectedness. Runa Hjarno Rasmussen, I hope I've got that right.
Put great effort into the pronunciation, in fairness. So,
Who hosts the channel? Yeah, I know, and you know,
you were practicing.
I was practicing, but it was a few weeks ago when we were initially meant to record this. Like, so
yes.
I kind of I meant to go back over it. Runa, who hosts the channel, also has a great book called The Nordic Animist Year, which yourself, Steffi, got me for Christmas along with the associated runic calendar.
Yeah, they sent it very promptly. Recommend their shop. But Dúchas.ie is a great place to explore how old Irish calendar customs survived into very recent times. Lou, on the advice of Melton Na Mórbhreathach, rejects Brez's offer to show them how to manipulate nature, but they do accept his offer to tell them the best days to sow crops and harvest crops. And now we use the term under which moon, but the Middle Irish manuscript version, Brez says, Marth an ar, Marth high courage, Sheila an earth, Marth nimbocht. Or in modern Irish, I think is De March a Trawa, Erin March an Sheil Cursagort, Ermarth a Morth, which translates as on Tuesday they're ploughing, on Tuesday they're sowing seed in the field, on Tuesday they're reaping. Shout out to Heather Small from M People. But anyway, sorry. Imagine if she listened to the podcast.
You never know.
I would love that.
Maybe she's going back to college to study Irish mythology, get her master's. She's moving on up.
Oh my God, Mark, that's brutal. That's a terrible joke.
Oh well, I suppose we move on. Things can only get better. That's the dream.
Oh my God.
Now, the surviving version of the saga.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
You can.
Just for listeners who aren't familiar with the group M People, that the line reap is, there was a charity celebrity thing 100,000 years ago where they did a cover of Perfect Day by Lou Reed. And that was the line that Heather Small said. No, I just, people are going to be like, what is she talking about? Makes no sense, you know, especially to our listeners, maybe like in parts of the world where that song did not reach. Anyway.
Went everywhere, didn't it? Was that the one that like Bono was in and all of them? If Bono was in it, it went everywhere.
Probably,
on the people's phones without their permission and everything.
Wouldn't it be gas if I must reread the lyrics and see is there a way we can say that that's actually about Brez. Anyway, go on.
So, as we're saying, the surviving version of the saga, the Second Battle of Moytura, was most likely compiled between the 9th and 10th centuries CE, so well after the Christianization of Ireland. And we don't know when our ancestors started using day names derived from the Latin. Mart, for example, Day Mart, comes from the Latin Dies Martis, which means the day of the god Mars. It's possible that these days arrived around the same time as Lou, with the arrival of refugees from Roman Britain or returning Irish exiles, like the semi-mythical Tuil Tekmer. And patrons of this podcast who are subscribed to our Patreon page will have heard a bonus episode that I did on Tuil Tekmer and the possibility that he was a semi-mythical version of an actual historical figure who got material support from the Roman Empire to come and take back part of Ireland.
But prior to that, it is possible that our ancestors used a lunar or lunisolar calendar with lunar rather than solar days, or both. Lunar days correspond to phases of the moon, and there is a tradition that has lasted into modern times of using the phases of the moon in agriculture, ploughing, sowing, and reaping on specific lunar days. You'll often see stuff like this in farmers' almanacs today.
And in the aforementioned book, The Nordic Animist Year, Rune writes of the moon, "The waxing period marked a time for all activities promoting growth, such as sowing fields or mating livestock. The increasing light of the growing moon was seen to imbue the world with life, potency and strength. Conversely, the waning moon could be the time to attack something, like boils or lice. Beer was brewed at this time so that the sacred power that would make the beer ferment would not destroy the brew, and farmers would sow the winter seed during the waning period so that the crops would not grow too soon before the onset of winter and be destroyed."
Brez's indication that there are specific days when you should conduct different activities would also put you in mind of the Vedic calendar, where certain days are auspicious times to get a haircut or start a new relationship or go on a journey. There are also days when you should not travel or not start a project, etc. Going with the natural flow of nature and the seasons and not manipulating nature and forcing the earth to do your bidding also has shades of the Tao, particularly a concept we have talked about on the show before, Wu Wei, or effortless action.
We talked about that in our episode covering part 4 of the Wing of Tain, and in the episode The Dagda's Club in Love and War. A very brief analogy would be swimming with the current rather than against it. There's much more to it than that, but just to give you kind of a mental picture. The second part of today's story involves the Dagda, Lu and Ogma going off to take back the cattle herd of Ireland and Dagda's harp. We added the part about Brez going to bring his mother Era or Eru in the older Irish back from captivity on his father's island stronghold.
Back in episode 17, Brez, Era and the Fomorians, we mentioned that Era appears in the oldest surviving text of the story as a device to explain Brez's origins. She goes with him to find his father and then disappears from the saga. In our version, we had Elaha keep her there through manipulation of magic and maybe narcissistic personality disorder, to explain her absence after that, because she has an important role in some upcoming episodes on the coming of the Milesians, the mythical ancestors of the Gaels, and we want to explain how she came back and maybe give Brez some small shot at redemption.
A bit like Loki in Norse mythology, the version of Brez in the Second Battle of Moytura is, you know, a bit of an asshole, but he does seem to love his family. The passage in the manuscript text of the saga is short and light on details, so we added the description of the island based on our description in episode 17, which is loosely based on the Isle of Skye. It's an interesting part of the story because the Dagda, Lu and Ogma go off together, three gods of immense power, and in the end, Lu and Ogma don't really have to do much.
The part where Ogma decapitates the Fomorian guards was our addition, partially because these guards appeared in our story the last time we visited Adlaha's stronghold, and also to include the Sword of Tara, whose appearance in the saga comes between the trial of Brez and Lu the Dagda Nokma setting out for Alaha's stronghold. Something else that is interesting in the scene at Alaha's Shi is what the Dagda does when he gets his harp back. He plays sorrowful music, joyful music, and sleep music, which is exactly the same thing as Lu does at Tara after he has claimed his place among the gods. And that was back in episode 19, The Rise of Lu.
We mentioned before a possible contrast between Lu and the Dagda. Lu is skilled in all of the arts and likes to tell everybody about it, whereas the Dagda is also skilled in all the arts, but he lets his actions do the talking. When Lu plays the harp for the other gods at Tara, there is an element of showing off, but here the Dagda plays it because it is essential to the success of the mission. It literally incapacitates the Fomorian soldiers that have shown up to stop him taking back the harp. Another callback to a previous episode was the heifer the Dagda takes with him.
The Dagda's heifer would be a great name for a pub.
It would, actually, yeah.
Yeah,
more of a kind of an English-style pub name, but I think we could, if we eventually buy a pub sometime, we'd call it that.
I think the Dagda's heifer does not sound English.
No, but, you know, pubs here are normally like such and such name.
Brady's.
Yeah, exactly.
Nolan's.
Yeah.
Barney Max.
Yeah.
Barney Max, best pint of Guinness and Drogheda.
It is, yeah.
Sarches does a good one too, though, in fairness.
Yeah. That's Sarsfields to anybody who's not from Drogheda.
That's, yeah, exactly. Anyway, look, we were talking about the Dagda. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. Way back in episode 10, the Dagda strikes back. The Dagda chooses a single heifer as compensation from Brez after being found not guilty of the murder of the poet Crithenbale. This is the heifer he brings, and she leads all the other stolen cattle out of Alaha's Shi so they can return to Ireland. The return of the cattle to Ireland, the liberation of the Dagda's harp, and the refusal of the Tuatha Dé to accept instruction in Fomorian magic to manipulate the cycles of growth and decay and of the seasons, coming at the conclusion of this saga, leaves us very good reason to believe that the balance of nature and the importance of the seasons are the overriding themes of the Second Battle of Moytura.
Going by the archaeological record, it seems that agriculture came out of a period of decline in the early centuries CE, right around the time when Lu seems to have come to prominence among the Irish gods. A story that tells of the coming of this god, the defeat of the race of giants that destroy crops and steal cattle, and of the return of the Dagda's harp, which is said to make the seasons fall in their proper order, might be the mythology the people of that time created to celebrate and explain a new era of prosperity. It could well be built upon an older story from a time when nomadic pastoral farming was the main form of economic activity. Hence the Dagda's continued importance.
In Irish folklore, you will find stories of the good folk or the Éisí. Among them, the more mischievous ones are known to steal butter and milk and interfere with crops and sometimes bring disease to livestock. Lower milk yields, crop failure and disease are part of the natural cycle of life. And in small doses, they are irritating but manageable events for a people that rely on farming for their livelihood. But if they occur with greater frequency than usual, they can be harder to manage and can lead to great hardship. This is what we think the Fomorians stand for in this saga. There is a place for them in nature, but they must be kept in their place by the gods.
There's another part of the conclusion of the saga that we left out. It comes straight after the part we retold in this episode. Most of the text is untranslated in the Elizabeth Gray and the Whitley Stokes translations, which was why we didn't include it. But at the very end, the Morrigan recites a poem prophesying the end of the world. The opening line is, "I shall not see a world which will be dear to me. Summer without blossoms, cattle will be without milk, women without modesty, men without valour, conquests without a king." And I think if there's any doubt as to the meaning of the Second Battle of Moytura, that also drums at home.
So we've left that particular part out because that's really all there is of it. And that is it for our retelling of the saga, the Second Battle of Moytura. 18 episodes, including the 3 retelling the first Battle of Moytura, and you'll be able to find a list of them all on irishmythologypodcast.ie. Next time around, we'll be turning our attention to the coming of the Milesians to Ireland. The Milesians are the mythical ancestors of the Gaelic people who, legend tells us, came from Galicia in the northwest of the modern Spanish state.
As well as retelling the story of their arrival, we'll be looking at the linguistic, genetic and archaeological theories about the origins of the Irish people. And maybe we'll add some theories of our own. But that is all we have time for today.
But if you can't get enough of Irish Mythology Podcast, you might consider becoming a patron. The show will always be free to listen to, but it is not free to make. You can support our work from as little as €3 a month, and you'll get story scripts and story-only audio, as well as early access to the next episode. From €5 a month, you can get access to extra bonus content. So you can sign up at patreon.com/Irish Mythology Podcast. But if you don't have cash to spare right now, you can support us by sharing our episodes with friends and family and on social media.
Speaking of social media, you can find us on Twitter at Irish Mythology P, on Facebook, Irish Mythology Podcast, on Instagram at Irish Mythology, and online at irishmythologypodcast.ie. And now also on Mastodon at Irish Mythology on the .ie server. And that's an awful mouthful, but we just have to run with it because that's how it goes. We also have a link tree, and you know where to find that. And if you are listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Amazon or another platform that includes ratings and you like the show, just do us a favor, give us a 5-star rating. It helps us reach a wider audience. And don't forget, share those episodes. You will be rewarded by the gods.
We are also on TikTok.
Oh, yeah.
And you can find us on TikTok. I just like every week is a new social media channel for me to forget to update. You can find us on TikTok. I can't remember. Search for us. I have two. There's Irish Mythology and Irish Mythology Podcast. We are both of those. So there's only one that has content on it, though. So pick that one. And remember, you should ask the gods when you want to do some planting. Because you've got to reap, reap, reap. I'm sorry, Heather Saul. Please keep listening. See you next time on the Irish Mythology Podcast. Slán.
You have been listening to the Irish Mythology Podcast. Written, presented and produced by Marcus O'Hishkin and Stephanie Nihirny. Theme music, Celtic Warrior by Damiano Baldoni on an attribution lawsuit.